Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Francis Beckwith, a professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University, where he also serves as associate director of the graduate program in philosophy, as well as co-director with Trent Doherty of the program on philosophical studies of religion in the Baylor Institute for Studies of Religion, the sponsor of this podcast. A graduate of Fordham University with a PhD and MA in philosophy, he also holds a Master of Juridical Studies at the Washington University School of Law in St. Louis, where he won a Cali Award for academic excellence. He writes, teaches, and speaks in the area of ethics, jurisprudence, religion, and politics, and is the author of numerous academic articles in a variety of journals, as well as several books, including A Second Look at First Things, A Case for Conservative Politics, Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, Return to Rome, Confessions of an Evangelical Catholic, Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion Choice, and most recently, Taking Rights Seriously, Law, Politics, and the Reasonableness of Faith, which will be the centerpiece of our discussion today. In 2008 and 2009, Professor Beckwith served on the faculty of the University of Notre Dame as the Mary Ann Remick Senior Visiting Fellow in the Center for Ethics and Culture. And a few years prior to that, he was a research fellow in the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions in the Department of Politics at Princeton University. Starting in the fall of this year, he will be the visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Lots more information about Dr. Beckwith, including links to his books, can be found at our website, www.researchonreligion.org, so stop on by. Frank, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you for having me.
I have to ask you this question after reading your bio here and practicing pronunciating it and all that. Do you ever get associated with any institutes that have less than six words in their title? I mean, I'm looking at Program on Philosophical Studies in the Religion at Baylor Institute Study for Religion. Oh, my gosh. And then the Remick
Senior
Visiting Fellow.
You know, it reminds me of those old church names, right? Like the, you know, the African Methodist Episcopalian Church of God in Christ. And now it's like, what, like Christian Life Center.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, that makes it easier, right?
Yeah, I guess we, you know, Trent Doherty, who's my co-director, we should have probably thought of a really nifty acronym or something. Mm. But I guess there's, I'm multisyllabic when it comes to institutions to which I'm affiliated.
Yeah, you must have really big business cards. That's what I'm thinking. Anyways, our goal today is not to talk about business cards and the length of institute names, but our goal instead is to talk about portions of your new book, Taking Rights Seriously, Law, Politics, and the Reasonableness of Faith. Now, before diving into the content specifically, I want to get some background on how this book came to be. So my first question is, how did this book come to be?
Well, it's a book that I'd been thinking about writing, in the early, about 10 years ago. And it was motivated by several different things that I had observed in the legal literature as well as in the popular culture on how not only intellectuals and professors talked about religious belief, but also how media, that time we didn't have social media, but sort of ordinary news media, as well as journalists and others in popular culture would talk about religious belief and the what we philosophers would call the epistemic status of religious belief. What is it that justifies a religious believer in claiming that their religious beliefs are rational? And so that got me you know, first thinking about it, there was actually an incident that I share at the beginning of the book. I was speaking at Texas Tech University Law School in 2004, and I was invited to talk about a book that I had published the year earlier called Law, Darwinism, and Public Education, and it was dealing with some of the issues concerning the teaching of Darwinism and the claims on the part of advocates of intelligent design that it would be permissible under our Constitution to teach intelligent design without violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. So I was invited to give this talk, and about 3 or 4 minutes into the question and answer period, there was a gentleman in the audience raised his hand, and he said he didn't really have a question. He said, you know, look, you've been talking to us for 50 or so minutes. All you've given us are religious arguments. Now, the fact is I don't even recall giving a religious argument, but I thought that's kind of an odd thing to say. So I thought for a second, and I paused, and I thought on the fly, thinking about how can I respond to this, and it just sort of occurred to me to just say to him, "Wow, I'm relieved. I thought you were going to say they were bad arguments." And the point of that, and that was, I'd say, the moment when a lot of the questions about how the culture thinks about religion kind of crystallized. I thought, you know, what's really going on here is this: people think that if you could put the adjective religious in front of something, somehow that's a signal to all the rest of us that the intellectual credentials of the claim are, by their very nature, not worth even assessing. And the more I began reading on how people deal with a lot of controversial questions in the public square, whether it's abortion or fetal research or marriage, or even questions about how, let's say, citizens should be thinking about influencing public policy on, let's say, public schools or anything like that, that one way in which people deal with those citizens is to simply say, "Oh, all you have are religious arguments," or "you're motivated by your religion." And that got me writing several academic articles that I published in different journals over the years, and that was the beginning of the book. And I took those articles and significantly revised them and added some new, what eventually became new chapters to what eventually became Taking Right Seriously. So that's the kind of the origin of the book, and for my own, you know, academic interest, the issues that I'm dealing with in the book are ones that I've been dealing with in different venues, mostly in philosophy, and it was only later, after I went to law school 15 years ago, that I began thinking about how these issues are kind of cashed out in the courts and in the public culture in ways that, let's say, professional philosophers don't really concern themselves with.
Now, you mentioned the book title, Taking Rights Seriously, and since this is an audio podcast, I'm going to spell out the word rights, R-I-T-E-S, and that seems to be a play on the word rights that you hear a lot in legal discourse, R-I-G-H-T-S, and also sounds a little reminiscent of a book in the past, too. So tell us a little bit about the title. How did you come up with that, and who came up with that, if it wasn't you?
Well, it is a play on words, and there was a book published in the early 1970s by the renowned philosopher of law, Ronald Dworkin, called Taking Right Seriously, R-I-G-H-T-S. And I did not invent or create the title. It was actually created by Paul Whiteman, who's a professor at the University of Notre Dame in the philosophy department. He published an article in 1994 in the Pacific Philosophical Quarterly called Taking Right Seriously, R-I-T-E-S. And I thought that's a great title for a book, and fortunately you can take titles without violation of copyright.
Yeah, there you go.
So, and I give him credit in the acknowledgments. I thought that was so clever. In fact, I was upset that I hadn't thought of it myself. And in fact, Whiteman's article unsurprisingly, actually deals with people like Dworkin and John Rawls and others who have offered a way of understanding the relationship between religion and politics. And Whiteman's critique of them is that they are not taking rights, R-I-T-E-S, seriously. So that's the origin of the title.
The other thing about the book, and I'm fascinated by these. I know we're not digging into the content quite yet, but I like all these little publishing details about the profession and things. The book cover. The book cover has a medieval church look to it, but most of your arguments tend to be contemporary. Who chose the book cover?
I did.
You did? Okay.
I actually designed the book cover, but if you look at the back, it says it was designed by John Brisson, who's like the in-house cover designer at Cambridge. Yeah. I'll tell you the story how it was designed. My wife and I were living in Rome in spring of 2015. I was there for research leave, working on doing some research on Thomas Aquinas. I have a future book that I'm working on the relationship between Thomas Aquinas' thought and contemporary American evangelical intellectuals. And so I wanted to study in Rome close to people at the Angelicum, which is the Pontifical University of Thomas Aquinas. So to make a long story short, so Cambridge emails me. My editor at Cambridge says, you know, we'd like for your opinion about possible covers. Do you just want words or do you want pictures? And here are these websites where you can look at different pictures. Well, that afternoon, my wife and I were walking to the Vatican post office, and we noticed that there was a postage stamp honoring the 1700th anniversary of the Edict of Milan, which was in the Roman Empire, granted religious liberty. And one of the stamps had this mural on it, which is called the Donation of Constantine. And so I thought, this is a great idea for a cover, because it's the first instance of, you know, religious liberty instituted by a government in world history. So, and it also involved Pope Stephen and Constantine. Now, there's a question of whether this actually really happened in real life, that is, whether Constantine really gave Pope Stephen a gift. But in any event, we actually went to the basilica, or the church that has the real mural on the wall. So I got to see it in real life. So then I thought, well, you know, the book mostly deals with contemporary issues. So if you look in the back, underneath my name, there's a kind of beige backing, but there's little handwriting. And the handwriting is Thomas Jefferson's, letter for establishing religious liberty or religious freedom. So what I did is, just with my Word software, I put in the background the Jefferson letter, faded it a little bit, and then put the photograph of the Donation of Constantine mural there. So that's the origin of the cover. So so there is a contemporary angle to it, but you really can't see it all that well. I mean, you can, if you look at it, if you read it closely, it says an act for establishing religious freedom at the very top, and that's authored by Jefferson. So I have, you know, the beginning in Western culture with the Donation of Constantine or the Edict of Milan, and then at the top is the sort of the modern, you know, the real first modern institution of religious liberty with Jefferson's act for establishing religious freedom. So that's the origin of the cover.
Yeah, very complicated. We'll post a picture of it up on our website so people can take a look at it, or better yet, just go out and buy the book so you can look at the cover. It's kind of neat that you explain it. And I know there's always stories behind covers, and, you know, a lot of readers don't really know all that goes behind those stories. So thank you for
that. Well, I wish that, you know, this is... I wish that they had given me credit in the back. In fact, when I designed the cover, they said that we sent it to the designer, and he likes it. And I said, just give me credit. It never, yeah. You know, it's one of those things. I assume that the bureaucracy of publishing houses, it never got there. So that's fine. But I'm proud to say that I designed it.
So. You got to push them on that a little bit more. My two books have my photos that I took on the covers, and I get credited. So I'm a published photographer too. So I like that. But let's talk about the book, right? It's you're talking about religious liberty, but it covers a lot more ground than just that. Maybe ways that people think of religious liberty narrowly. You broaden this much more, and you go into a lot of contentious issues today, including bioethics, abortion, intelligent design, same-sex marriage, and a few other things. But you make a main argument, and that argument, there's one thing here connecting the conflictual nature of all these things, and that's a fundamental misunderstanding about the relationship between faith and reason. Explain that.
Yeah. One of the things that I discovered while working on the book was the number of legal scholars that have an understanding of religion that I think is inadequate. And so I think the best way to explain it is to go over what some of these thinkers have suggested. So I select three to cover, and there are others. There's Stephen Gay, Susanna Sherry, and Brian Leiter. In fact, Leiter I focus on more than anyone. He just recently published a book called Why Tolerate Religion. And in that book, he says, we should tolerate religion, but not because religion is special, but because it goes under some kind of general right to autonomy. So, to use an example, my example, people should be free to attend church just like they should be free to attend Rolling Stones concerts. It's simply under sort of a general right to pursue whatever vision of the good life you think is adequate for yourself, as long as you don't interfere with others' similarly situated rights. But there's nothing special about religion. However, this is where Leiter then does say, yes, but if we look at religious beliefs and what they claim, they really are not rational. So unlike, let's say, regular matters of taste, let's say my aesthetic judgments about the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan or Mozart, we can have arguments about those things, but religious beliefs seem to be the sorts of beliefs that are outside the purview of reason. And so Leiter adds something more to his critique. So he says, yeah, we should tolerate religion not because there's anything special. In fact, religion's irrational. But as long as, people don't hurt others, we're fine with that. Now, what I suggest I offer a detailed critique of this point of view, but my critique, the reason why I'm interested in this is not because, at the end of the day, Leiter is going to let the religious citizen do whatever he wants, but the religious citizen also doesn't only want to be left alone, he or she wants to advance what they believe is the common or public good. And so if you say, for example, that a belief that is tightly tethered to a religious tradition is by nature irrational, that means that those citizens shouldn't even be allowed to make their case. And even if they're allowed to make their case, their argument should not be treated with any seriousness. So I critique the view, or I call the view secular rationalism. And it really is kind of there's two prongs to it. One is that religious beliefs are not subject to the kind of ordinary analysis that we find, for example, in the hard sciences. And another aspect of it is that religious believers treat their beliefs in a categorical fashion. That is, we believe, those of us who are religious believers, that we're correct and that we're willing to, in some cases, even die for our beliefs. And concerning the latter, Leiter says, well, this is also true of a lot of secular beliefs, so he's not going to really deal with that. He's going to deal with the question of rationality. And he says, as I've already noted, religious beliefs are irrational because they can't be assessed under the ordinary canons of the hard sciences or common sense. The claim that God exists or that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead or anything of that sort just simply can't be assessed rationally. And so therefore, religious belief is beyond assessment by the ordinary means by which we assess claims about the world.
Yeah, it gets to this whole notion that democratic statecraft is itself a science, and that we need to apply reason to this. And since religion is not reason, it's not scientifically determined, it's all categorical, as you say, people can believe it, but they just got to kind of keep it at home. And when they go into the public square or the voting booth or public office, they just have to push that aside, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so the distinction I make at the very beginning of the chapter is that there's a difference between, let's say, you know, religious liberty in terms of, like, as you've pointed out, like, you know, just being, you know, being devout at home versus, let's say, going out into the public square and advocating your views and even, let's say, campaigning for particular candidates and ballot questions and legislation that you think advances the common good and happens to be motivated by your religious beliefs.
Yeah. So what's wrong with this secular rationalism position? You go into a couple critiques of it.
Well, there's a couple of problems with it. One problem is it's a real kind of simple problem that it's sort of surprising to me that Leiter kind of ignores this problem, because in philosophy, this is kind of standard fare when it comes to critiquing what had once been called logical positivism. That is, this view that the only things that we can really know are either things true by definition or things that we can empirically verify. And one of the flaws with this view is that the view itself is not true by definition or can be empirically verified. It's something, it's a set of first principles that people believe by which they look at the world. So I call this problem that the view that secular rationalism is epistemically suspect, that it starts with this assumption that can't, or this criterion that cannot even fulfill itself. Secondly, it's not only epistemically suspect for that reason, it's also suspect because there's lots of things we believe that seem perfectly rational that don't fall under that. So, my belief, for example, that it's wrong to torture children for fun. I can't really prove that empirically in the same sense that I can prove that the grass is green or that yesterday was Monday, right? There's a different sort of belief. Or something like we ought to treat all human beings with dignity, or let's say that I have memories of my high school days. I have these memories, but I can't prove those empirically. I simply trust my cognitive faculties, including memory. So there's lots of these things that we believe. In fact, it's interesting, Leiter himself talks about in his book some of the bad things done by religious believers in history. And of course, his moral assessments of all these atrocities can't be proven by the scientific method. So it's clear that just even if before we even get into the question of religion, there are lots of things that we believe that that don't fall under that. I mean, others include aesthetic judgment. So if I say, for example, the Mona Lisa is beautiful, and somebody says to me, well, you know, I've studied chemistry for 10 years, and I don't see any beauty. Well, that's not where, you know, to paraphrase the country singer Johnny Lee, you're looking for beauty in all the wrong places, right? It's, that's not... It's something that we can know, but it's not like things we know in the hard sciences. So I think that's one problem with it, is this, what I call, it's epistemically suspect.
Okay.
Well, one is that I think it begs, I put it under the general category, begs substantive questions. And what I mean there is that Leiter just assumes, and this is true of the other writers too, Susanna Sherry and Stephen Gay, that religious believers just don't have any arguments. I mean, and it's weird because the literature, at least in my discipline, philosophy, over the past 50 years, has been amazing in terms of the kinds of arguments and the qualities of arguments that theists, that is, believers in God, have been offering. There's actually been, since the late 60s, a kind of renaissance in philosophy in terms of theism and, in particular, Christian philosophy. And there are just mountains of books, articles that have been published by some of the most well-regarded philosophers, who are well-regarded not because of just because they happen to be theists, and you know, and they're popular among the religious believers, but these are considered to be very good philosophers as philosophers. So it's an odd sort of blind spot on the part of these authors. Now, Leiter does briefly mention these works, but he doesn't act, other than citing, I think, the works of Bill Alston and Alvin Plantinga, he ignores, I mean, all the other literature, doesn't really deal with it. He just in kind of hand waves it away. He says, look, virtually all the people that write in this area are religious believers anyway, so, you know, what do you expect? They're going to defend religious belief. I thought that's a weird criticism. It'd be like if there was a book written by a materialist, and I said, "Well, I'm not going to read it because he's a materialist, and you know he's going to defend materialism." So what do you expect? I mean, it's an odd thing to charge somebody for, you know, defending what they believe as somehow ruling out taking it seriously. So it's a really strange. So he doesn't really deal with, you know, to his credit, he does mention it. But he simply hand waves it away.
One of the last critiques you make of secular rationalism is that it confuses religion with specific beliefs. Now, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, so let's look at an example. Something like, let's say, the issue of abortion. The fact is, if you look at the social science data, a vast majority of people that oppose abortion are religious believers, and most of those religious believers are some sort of Christian. Now, there are obviously opponents of abortion that are not religious believers, and there are religious believers who oppose abortion who are not Christians. That's empirically true, but the vast majority are Christians. And the reason for that, I think their opposition to abortion, if you look in the Christian history, and it's the history of its moral theology, there has been a long-standing condemnation of abortion. Now, that, although true, doesn't necessarily mean that one cannot have arguments for the belief that abortion is wrong that are not connected to the theological tradition. And there are some. There are many of them. In fact, I cite a variety of different authors showing that that you know there are arguments offered by people who oppose abortion that rely on premises that are not derived from any religious doctrine or any scripture or any creeds. They are simply sort of commonsensical appeals to philosophical and scientific reasons, and from those reasons the individual infers that abortion is wrong in some way. Now, I think abortion's is oddly enough, I've always thought that it's one of the easier issues to make to cite that kind of example. But the truth is, if you read the literature again, including some Supreme Court opinions, most people assume that that the opponent of abortion simply has theological or scriptural arguments, and that's it. So now, to give another example that's probably makes it, I think, clearer, is supposing, you know, one believes in the existence of a soul, that is, that there's an immaterial aspect to human beings that can't be reduced to our physical nature. The fact is, again, most people that believe in the existence of the soul are religious believers. But the fact also is that the idea that there's a soul has been defended by numerous thinkers, Aristotle, Plato, for example, Cicero, other great philosophers throughout history who have not been in any way connected to any religious tradition as we know it today. And even in contemporary times, there have been several philosophers, none of whom are religious believers, who have argued for the existence of the soul. Now, of course, the idea of a soul is prominent in Scripture. It's mentioned in the Quran. Clearly, there religious believers believe there's a soul, but that doesn't mean there can't be good philosophical arguments for the existence of the soul.
Okay. So now, all of these arguments that you make against secular rationalism, I mean, this could all be a big parlor game for intellectuals sipping brandy in high back chairs. You're using these terms epistemical and all those kind of things. This is just philosophers debating. Does this stuff have any real world impact? And that's what I want to turn to next. And your chapter 3 in your book talks about how a lot of these ideas manifest themselves in our court system. And given that you have a legal background, this is your wheelhouse. Explain how these philosophical debates become manifested in our everyday life through the court system.
Well, let me give you, there's several different examples I can give. Let me, it's a great case. It's not well known in the by most people. It's a Supreme Court case dealing with abortion called Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, which was I think a 1989 case. And there's a dissent by Justice John Paul Stevens, where he claims that let me tell you what the case is about. A Missouri statute that required that limited most abortions to prior to 20 weeks of pregnancy, and after that, the woman seeking the abortion had to undergo tests to see if the fetus is viable, and she had also be informed about the nature of fetal development. And there's a preamble in the statute that said that life begins at conception. Now, it's interesting. It's not part of the law. In other words, the law doesn't make an assertion about when human life begins. All it does is have these regulations. But Stevens latches onto the preamble, and he says, look, this particular claim here, it's a religious belief, because we all know, he doesn't use this language, but he's saying something like this. You know, the fetus really doesn't have any interest until, you know, it develops to a certain point where it can sense things. So what he's done here is that he's now connected. He's saying that a particular view of the human person that he holds is sort of the scientific, rational, logical view. But what he doesn't realize is that the so-called religious position that he says is out of bounds has for itself numerous arguments to show that, yeah, why should you believe that, on what grounds should we believe that having sort of awareness or the opportunity to sense things. Why is that necessary for one to be considered a person under the law? I mean, after all, we can think of cases where full-grown adults have, let's say, over short periods of time, lost consciousness or the ability to sense things, and yet we don't say that they've somehow ceased to be human beings in the fullest sense. But here's my point. What Stevens is doing, and it turns out Stevens' view doesn't become law, right? I mean, it's a dissenting opinion, and the Supreme Court never actually says that the pro-life view is definitively religious. But that type of thinking clearly is going to have, maybe future courts pick up this dissent. But here's my point. By saying that one of two different views on the nature of the human person is religious, and secondly, can't be defended by secular reason. Therefore, any law that attempts to place this, or any legislature that tries to place this as a law, violates the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. But what Stevens is really doing, and this happens in, I think, virtually every one of the issues that I go over, he takes what should be a dispute between two different answers to one question and turns it into two different subjects. So instead of, the question is, when does human life begin? And what does Stevens do? He says, it's this position is religious, the other is secular. So by doing that, though, he changes what should be two different contrary answers to the same question into two different subjects. And of course, because religion is considered to be somehow sub-rational, it is then off the table as a legitimate subject of public discourse.
And that's what connects this back to the First Amendment. And I think the really important thing that is overarching in your entire book, that, yeah, there's these all these specific cases and how we interpret things, but this has huge impacts on how we understand the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and how it's put out there in practice. Explain that.
That's right. The case of one of the cases I go over in the book, Wallace versus Jaffrey. It's a case involving school prayer, and there's a better case. It's like the school prayer case. It's something I talk about in the last chapter of the book. It's almost the quintessential ceremonial deism case. It involves the Pledge of Allegiance that was required of all public school students to recite in a Northern California public school district. What happened, there was a gentleman there named Newdow who sued the school district on behalf of his daughter, and he argued that the idea or the phrase under God, because that phrase is now in the Pledge of Allegiance, and actually wasn't in the Pledge of Allegiance until 1954. There were Pledge of Allegiance cases before 1954, but it dealt with just whether a religious believer should be coerced to recite it. It had nothing to do with the religious nature of the pledge. So these later cases deal with the alleged religious nature of the pledge. And so the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals strikes it down and says that it's a violation of the Establishment Clause because we all know that religion, the idea of God is religious, and therefore, this violates, the Constitution. And then it gets, on appeal, the Supreme Court actually kind of punts on it. They basically say that Mr. Newdow doesn't have standing because he doesn't even have partial custody or joint custody with his daughter, so he can't sue. So basically, the case doesn't get resolved. It only gets resolved in this sense. The Ninth Circuit's overturned. But here's why this is a really interesting case. Again, it's one of these cases where, it looks like it's so obviously religious to most people. But one of the points I make is this. Go back and read why the pledge was changed. Well, the 1954 Congress, in the height of the Cold War, wanted to distinguish the American understanding of rights from the Soviet understanding of rights. And the view held by most people at the time and a lot of people today is that our rights are ultimately derived from a divine source, a God. And so they included under God in order to make the claim that to distinguish the American understanding from the understanding of materialism, which was embraced by the Soviet Union. So what the Congress was trying to do in 1954 was to answer a philosophical question. What is the origin and nature of our rights? It's the sort of question that gets answered by a variety of philosophers historically, going all the way back to people like Aristotle and Plato. Although they didn't use the language of rights, these are questions of the nature of morality get answered throughout people like Cicero, Augustine, Aquinas, Kant, Hume. So the point that I make is all that Congress was trying to do was to answer a philosophical question that is a live question, and in a sense, God is not really playing a religious role. He's playing a philosophical role. God is being employed to account for something that virtually everyone believes is true. We have natural rights. Where do they come from? And so what's interesting is that when the Supreme Court, even though they wind up saying that Mr. Newdow doesn't have standing, they say, well, this is part of our nation's traditions and history. And then the Ninth Circuit judge says, well, it's just religious. And what I'm suggesting is that there's a third option, that this is a intellectually serious answer to a very important question. And the fact that it happens to be align itself with a theological tradition doesn't count at all against the quality of the arguments, right? I mean, people like Ronald Dworkin, for example, argue that we don't need God for rights. Well, other people argue differently. It's the same it's the same question, but with different answers. And so in any event, that's another example where ignoring the intellectual credentials of a religious belief just simply eliminates from the sight of the judges and justices an option that they could very well have employed without, by the way, violating the individual rights of school children. A child could still exempt themselves based on conscience from reciting that. So it didn't even affect that. And all that it did, all that it would have done would have been to acknowledge that this was a serious question, that the state chose to answer it this way. It didn't at all step on anyone's rights. And if the state had chosen to answer it differently, if it had said, we don't need God, it could have done that too. That's just the way in which the democratic cookie crumbles.
Yeah. How would this play out in terms of interpreting in terms of First Amendment rights, such as the right to free exercise or the non-establishment clause? Those two things tend to get conflated oftentimes in the legal process.
Yeah, well, where you get into problems with free exercise and non-establishment are cases where, so let's say the recent Hobby Lobby case, there were some people arguing that by giving Hobby Lobby an exemption, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think Justice Ginsburg may have said this in her dissent, by giving Hobby Lobby an exemption, somehow the government now was treating religion special and therefore was establishing religion in a kind of indirect way, right? So this is actually one of the arguments that Leiter uses, that if we were to, there's a case that he talks about at the beginning of his book, of a Sikh, a young man who's part of the Sikh religion, who has to carry with him a particular type of knife, which is symbolic of entering manhood, sort of like a kind of bar mitzvah for Sikhs, I guess. And he goes to school. This is actually a real case. He goes to school with the knife, and he is, of course, told to remove it and to turn it in because there's a prohibition on knives. And he winds up making the argument in court that this is a free exercise. This is a question of free exercise. And Leiter says, "Well, why? If some kid wants to carry a knife because he wants to protect himself, isn't that privileging religion?" And so this is, and by privileging religion, you're now violating the Establishment Clause. So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the only way to resolve this is to actually make an argument that religion is something special. I mean, you have to actually make that argument and defend it. But the problem is that for the past 30 or 40 years, religious believers have been making the argument that religion, in terms of, let's say, religious practices that involve freedom of expression, that it's simply just another form of freedom of speech. So what's happened is that those who have been more critical of religion have taken that and taken it the other way and have said, well, if religion is just, you know, religious speech is simply another form of speech and ought to be treated that way. Well, why can't we treat religion as simply another form of human expression without any specialness to it?
Mm-hmm. And hence, that is why we need to take rights, R-I-T-E-S, yeah. seriously. Yeah. See how this connects. One of the other interesting chapters in your book deals with a bit of a personal intellectual journey that you went through. And it also connects to these cases like the Newdow case and the Sikh knife in school, dealing with intelligent design and the teaching of evolution or Darwinism versus creationism versus intelligent design. Speak to us about that chapter, because that was, for you, an interesting journey that you've had over the last 10, 15 or so years.
Yeah, I became interested in intelligent design. And let me just define what I mean by that. Intelligent design is a kind of cluster of theories or perspectives that say that that we can detect design in nature, and design meaning some level of specified complexity. So I don't want to call it one theory, because there are a variety of different arguments that people offer, and it's usually presented as a contrary account to Darwinian evolution. And so the most popular writers on this and the most sophisticated are actually friends of mine, Michael Behe and William Dembski. And they offer these arguments to show that the Darwinian account of the development of the species, of the origin and development of the species, can account for some organic entities or parts of organic entities that seem to be irreducibly complex. Something's irreducibly complex, meaning it means that it can't have a precursor or a predecessor. So, they use different examples like the bacterial flagellum, which is a part of a cell, the circulatory system of organisms, and so forth. And they offer largely secular arguments. Now, I was intrigued by this when I was in the late 1990s. In fact, was invited by Biola University in 1996 to be a participant in a conference called Mere Creation. And it brought together different critics of materialism, including people that now are known as intelligent design advocates, people that were theistic evolutionists, and people that were sort of hardline creationists. That is, to define creationism. Creationism is the view that we ought to interpret the first several chapters of the book of Genesis in the most literal fashion. And any scientific view that seems to be contrary to that has to be mistaken. So creationists typically start with scripture, whereas intelligent design advocates, although I'm critical of their view, they don't begin that way. Many of them are religious believers, but they want to make kind of secular arguments, and they don't care about things like, the age of the earth or how we should interpret the Bible in terms of their theory. They may have concerns about that personally, but not in terms of their theory. Back in 96, I was invited to participate in this conference. I was intrigued by it because I had never been a creationist. I had actually never written on the subject. It's a kind of third rail of in the evangelical world in which I had, you know, resided for most of my career. And so I kind of stayed away from it. I actually had no problem with evolution as a theory. It was not a big deal to me. But I never wrote on it or talked about it because I just thought it didn't interest me, and there was nothing to gain by kind of, defending my views. I didn't really care that much about it. So, but this intrigued me because the intelligent design guys were much different than the old-time creationists. They were, you know, very well credentialed. They held academic appointments at very good institutions. They had published in peer-reviewed journals and so forth. And so I became interested in reading more about it. And then when I went to law school in 2000-2001, I earned a degree at Washington University School of Law in St. Louis. And it wasn't an ordinary JD. It was a degree called a Master of Juridical Studies, which is a graduate degree in law, where I took most of the first year law courses as well as upper division courses, and unlike a regular JD, I had to write a dissertation. And my dissertation was on a Supreme Court case called Edwards versus Aguilar, 1987 Louisiana case that overturned a statute that required equal treatment between creation and evolution. And I, the question I wanted to answer in my dissertation was, could you teach intelligent design and not violate the holding in that opinion? And I concluded, yes, you could, that there was nothing about intelligent design in terms of the way in which the defenders of it presented their arguments that would violate the Establishment Clause. And it turns out, I mean, clearly that there are implications of the theory for belief in God, but that in itself, in my judgment, shouldn't have anything to do with whether it should be taught. I mean, after all, there is certain ways of studying history that, or political science or any other discipline, that may have a negative or a positive impact on people's religious beliefs, and yet we don't think that that rules out teaching it, right? I mean, the most important thing is whether you can offer arguments and whether the arguments are plausible. So I was intrigued by ID. I kind of was sympathetic towards it, but I never really, you know, defended it. I didn't, you know, I kind of laid low a little bit on that. And then in the 2004, 2005, about a little, maybe a year or two after the book came out, I began sort of doubting whether ID not so much worked as a theory, but how it accounted for what philosophers and theologians call divine action. I, you know, because most of the arguments for ID try to sort of exclude both chance and law in scientific theory. So, for example, someone like Behe, or better yet, Bill Dembski will say, if there's some natural phenomenon that cannot be accounted for by either scientific law or chance or randomness and is so improbable and exhibits a kind of complexity, if it reaches a certain level at which it is so improbable that we're justified in inferring that it's been designed by a mind. And this is what occurred to me. And I was helped out, by the way, by reading several books that really changed the way I thought about this. It occurred to me that as a theist, as a Christian believer, I also believe that God, the designer, also designed the law and the chance. So what I thought to myself, well, that means that you've got atheists and theists arguing about this really thin sliver of nature. But that's not what theists actually believe. We believe that God is the creator of everything. And so I thought it's teaching people the wrong lesson about divine action. That is, it teaches people this, that unless you find some sort of gaps in nature, there's no room for God. And I think that is a dangerous way to think about this question, because it also kind of leads sort of ordinary church-going believers to believe that their entire faith is contingent upon the latest scientific theory. And I don't think that's the right way to think about theology. So that's my personal story and why I was interested in this question.
And how does that play out in the book in terms of the arguments about secular rationalism and then filtering through the court system?
Yeah, so what I do in that chapter, I'm critical of both the ID advocates as well as those that are critical of ID, and I take on the opinion of a judge in the Second Circuit. I'm not sure what it was a federal district court. I'm sorry, federal district court. I think it was 10 years ago or 11 years ago, 2005. It was the Dover Kitzmiller case. It involved a law. Actually, it was a public school board put this provision in their curriculum that said that at the beginning of every semester in which a certain biology course was taught, the teacher had to stand up and tell the students that evolution was just a theory, not a fact, and that they could go to the library and find this book called Pandas and People that would show them about intelligent design, and that was pretty much it. And in the case, the case was eventually won by the plaintiffs who sued the school district, a group of families. And what was interesting about the opinion, the judge in the case says in several places, he talks about the importance of education, that we should be concerned about being good citizens, that the school district should be in the business of advancing the academic excellence of those under its care. And the point that I make in this chapter is that that kind of language is ironically design language. That is, it's the language of intrinsic purpose, and that the mistake that both the critics of intelligent design make, as well as I think the intelligent design advocates, is that they ignore the fact that that the way in which we think about, let's say, our personal excellence, our ethical obligations, the obligations that we have to make sure that the electorate is educated, that the children in our community receive an adequate academic presentation of certain views, that kind of presupposes that our minds are intrinsically ordered to some end or good. Now, the reason why I think both sides ignore that type of design is that they're functioning under a kind of mechanistic view of nature, that nature is sort of like watches and computers. It's just sort of stuff connected together if any sort of design has to be accounted for by some sort of external agent. And what I'm arguing is that there's more to nature than just that. And so my criticism of people like Richard Dawkins, as well as the judge in the Dover case, is that even though I think some of their criticisms of ID are correct, that they are ignoring the fact that there's other types of design that I think do point towards a transcendent creator that don't involve at all having to challenge anything in contemporary science. In fact, I argue in the chapter that contemporary science itself presupposes this type of design. And so the point is that I think that there's a right way to think about this, that on the one hand, I think takes the beliefs of the religious believers seriously, but at the same time doesn't sound like one is a reactionary against every recent scientific innovation and insight.
Yeah. Some very interesting arguments in that chapter, and you also have a number of other chapters that go into issues such as bioethics, prenatal life, and same-sex marriage, and we don't have time to cover those today, but I do want to point people back to your book, Taking Rights Seriously, to see how you wrestle with these issues in terms of your general interpretation of secular rationalism and the religious arguments that are made here, too. I want to close off by thinking about how difficult it is in a democratic society, and especially in a legal environment where oftentimes bright lines have to be drawn. We're going to do this and not that, and that's how it's going to be. How one reconciles this conflict between secular rationalism and a more religious view, or taking rights seriously, as you say in the title, how do you reconcile that, and where do you see the United States heading in the next, I don't know, 10 or 20 years in terms of reconciling that in the court system? Are you pessimistic or optimistic?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know what to think about. I mean, I've got a pessimistic side, and I'm pessimistic whenever I get online and I read, you know, certain blogs and writers that are so hostile to religion that I think, my Lord, these individuals are influencing a generation of young people who are going to think that this is the correct and only way to think about these questions, and they're going to also be arrogant and confident about it.
And become lawyers.
That's right, and become lawyers. One of the points I make in the chapter where I discuss the Hobby Lobby case is that that a lot of what I call the friends of religious liberty, I think, rely too heavily on just legal precedent. So they think, well, we have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the First Amendment and all these precedents. We're going to win these cases. I think they really underestimate the power of culture to shape people's understanding and reading of those precedents and those provisions in the Constitution as well as in legislation. So the next generation, so for example, look what's happened in the past year and a half with the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that different states have tried to pass. You've had major corporations come in and, you know, thwart the lobby and then eventually make sure that this legislation isn't passed. We saw last year in 2015 in Indiana and also in Arkansas, this year in Georgia and other places. And even though, you know, I think the arguments for the religious liberty are very strong, the arguments aren't getting out there. So I think the only way, I think, to get people to think about these things is we those of us who hold these views have to get our hands dirty. That there's no magic bullet. There's no silver bullet, right? No, I think the culture is clearly against, is moving in that direction, against religious liberty. People have been deeply influenced by thinking about religious liberty as merely sort of personal subjective preferences concerning one's individual worship. And what's remarkable about this, Tony, is for the past 50 years, I've seen in my profession this renaissance of sophisticated arguments for religion and for the rationale of religious belief. For some reason, it kind of just stayed in that small enclave among academics. And so, you know, this is why the project that I've been working on is an attempt to sort of forget what preacher once said this, you have to take the hay down from the loft and put it on the ground so the cows can eat it, right? You have to, you know, you have to take this and show it to people who are unacquainted with it. So there's a part of me that's pessimistic, but then I do a lot of speaking at universities around the country and also at religious institutions, universities, religious institutions such as my own, Baylor University, and other Christian colleges, and I see young people that are fairly sophisticated who know this, who know these arguments. And so it's difficult, you know, it's difficult to say, but if I had to answer it one way or another, I guess I'm a little pessimistic. I think the part that's most frustrating is that I have a suspicion that there are people out there who just don't care about the arguments. That is, you can make these arguments, and at the end of the day, all they care about is winning a cultural war, and it doesn't really matter. And so that means we have deeper issues, right? And the deeper issues are ones of intellectual integrity and what it means to be a good citizen. So I guess I'm a little pessimistic.
Well, you are making the first step in a more optimistic future by publishing your book, Taking Rights Seriously, because you are, as you said, taking the hay down from the loft and putting it down there so that the cows can eat it. And even though this is Cambridge University Press, very accessible book, enjoyable read, it will challenge a lot of people intellectually. So all you cows, get out there and chew this up. My guest today has been Francis Beckwith. Frank, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company.
See you next week.